Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. Today, I'm welcomed by my friend and co-host, Renee Vaslios. Hey, Renee.
Hi, Aaron.
It has been a bit.
It has. Thank you for having me again.
Oh, you're always welcome. You always bring such a wealth of information and knowledge and active listening questions. Good stuff.
Pressure's on. Thanks, Aaron.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Hey, let's read a bit of your background, and then we'll jump into today's conversation. Renee Vaslios is a Dutch-American agricultural economist with over 15 years of agricultural know-how. Your expertise ranges from strategic market analysis to product development to sales, marketing, and distribution strategy. With nearly a decade of international work experience in Amsterdam and 6 years in Beijing, you have a good understanding of what it takes to feed a shrinking planet. Today, your company Banyan Consulting leverages your global cross-functional experience from working from the USDA to John Deere to support the growth of sustainability-focused agricultural businesses. Right on?
That's right. And also the investor community.
And the investor community, yes. We were actually at a recent engagement where we were on a panel together in New York at the High Water Women's Conference focused on regenerative agriculture. That was fun.
That was fun. It was very exciting for me to see kind of how many folks were engaged and wanted to be part of that conversation.
Yeah, diverse mix, right? And we had folks that were LPs, GPs, institutional investors, all different, a plethora of individuals. It was focused, I think, mostly on empowering more women to look at things differently within the space. But I found it to really just be as a collective. We talked about regenerative agriculture and there happened to be more women in the room.
Yeah, no, exactly. I was really pleased with kind of the traction and the energy around the conversation.
Yeah, it was fun. Cool. Well, let's start the conversation today talking about grains. Okay, so grains are an interesting thing, right? This is what we think of being somewhat of a certain locations within the country or the world that we do heavy-handed commodity grain production. So the world total grain production is forecasted, this is a recent report that I read, is forecasted to hit a 3-year low, believe it or not, which is falling short of demand in keeping global trade strong. This is from the International Grain Council. They released this information after the 48th Council session, which happened in Paris, France on December 4th. I set that up because this is a global commodity stream that we're talking about. The IGC members assess the latest supply and demand outlook and market development for grains, rice, and oilseeds, as well as recent changes in national policies and administrative matters, I guess, as a collective. At a 3-year low of 2.1 billion tons, we're talking a lot, world total grains of wheat and coarse grains, production was forecast to go down by 24 million tons on a year-to-year average. And we're talking about, to give some context, wheat is the third largest food commodity traded in the world, representing around $45 billion a year. That's as of 2013. You know what the largest traded commodity food is in the world? I was a little surprised by this. It is seafood at $130 billion. That's a lot of product. And when you talk about everything coming from the sea, I guess I understand that. But to give some context, $45 billion, U.S. dollars in 2013 for wheat. Another trend that we would associate that to is that this is a huge industry spiraling out of control, running on razor thin margins, with not geared for mass concern or climate disruption. So, you know, Renee, one thing I think that would be interesting to get from your perspective on this, coming from John Deere, working with some of the largest grain producers in the world, and now working in the consultancy in sustainable agriculture, it seems we're moving away from these megaplex, huge monolithic approach, or at least in perspective, the interest seems to be moving towards interest of regional production, returning to actually put commodity or grains into a new iterative.
I'm not seeing it at scale yet. I think...
Bring us right back to earth.
Yeah.
I like it. All right.
crash us back down here. When we're talking about feeding kind of the global when you're talking about feeding a China and an India and all of Southeast Asia, it will be really difficult to do that with a regional food system. Is there demand from developed countries for that regional? Yes. Is it being met in the U.S.? No. So there's absolutely an opportunity in the U.S. In terms of scale, global scaled production, I don't see that going away.
Right.
Do I think it needs to change? Production practices need to change. Absolutely.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I think it's maybe aspirational at this point. Well, today's conversation, we welcome a guest. I think that's going to add some light on this situation. I'm excited for today's conversation because we're welcoming a good friend joining us from Portland, Maine. Today we welcome Gray Harris, who's the Senior Vice President of Coastal Enterprise Incorporated. Hey, Gray, how you doing?
Good, Aaron. Good to be here. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Gray. Wonderful to have you.
So, Gray, you are the CEI, Coastal Enterprise, Inc., is based out of Brunswick, Maine, and it's an organization with a mission to help create economically, environmentally healthy communities in which all people, especially those with low income, can reach their full potential. And I want to get into this. I want to talk more about what that means for Maine, for the region, for the work that you're doing. But let's talk a bit more about the grains and the wheat concept before we do that. So I read a recent article in Civil Eats that quoted you talking about Aurora Farms and the Maine grains, I believe it was. And you said, we're looking at the market opportunity. With the explosion of craft brewing and artisanal baking, there is a market demand for flours and malt and heritage and local grains. So in Maine, in New England, where we have a bit of a petri dish here, and we have also been in a spot, maybe it's the game theory, where we haven't had much production, where we did 150 years ago, we had quite a bit of production. Are we looking more regionally and locally at these things? And is this a growth channel for businesses?
Well, Aaron, that's a great question, and I think my answer is yes. As Renee said, it's, you know, this question of scale, and we're always going to see commodity scale, but more and more on the regional and local level, we're looking at folks trying to add value to these premium crops in these more niche markets, and the craft brew market is certainly one of them. As a matter of fact, because I do work in food and can't really go anywhere without
the reveal.
Bringing the reveal. It's a total setup, Aaron. Is Lunch India Pale Ale from Maine Beer Company, one of our craft brew companies. It's really blazing a trail in craft brew industry for consumption after this podcast. And what's really wonderful is that they represent the grain value chain on this more local or regional level in Maine. They're a wonderful company. They belong to 1% for the planet. They have starting wages that are well above minimum wage. They offer full benefits. And they source their malt from one of our other portfolio companies, Blue Ox Malt House. Mm. We can talk about that in a second, too. And they make extraordinary beer. And because the craft brew industry is so collaborative, it's certainly there's competition, but they're also bringing the whole industry with us. And what we're seeing is a real revitalization of not only the artisanal nature of creating this incredible product, and frankly, with food, the best way to talk about a product is to experience it. Mm-hmm. It really tells its own story. But we're seeing a revitalization of the grain economy in many ways. So this is for you all to enjoy after the show, but it's a great way to showcase what we see as businesses that make up our communities that we frankly can take for granted. You know, these are the reasons we live in these rural places or in the communities that we choose. And we just know, you know, maybe we know they're there, but we don't understand the impact they're really having on a number of different levels, but certainly in the agricultural economy.
Yeah, I think it's a good opportunity. This beer, specifically Maine Beer Company, which I'm a big fan of. And Lunch is my favorite. Holy cow. Gray, you know what you're doing here. Mm-hmm. You're always welcome to come on. is a good example, though, because it's part of that experience. Surely more expensive, but boy, you get something unique here, right? This is not Budweiser. This is not Coors. You get some value. There's flavor profiles. It's an experience.
It's an experience, yeah. Yeah.
And actually something, thank you so much, Gray. Mm-hmm. That's a, mm-hmm. we'll have to share next time I'm on mm-hmm. what we thought of the beer. Mm-hmm. I haven't had a chance to try it yet. So what I'm actually really excited about is while this is happening at a smaller scale, a lot of the industry that supports these growers that are at a smaller scale, so kind of the input suppliers for a main beer company, a lot of alternative inputs, so production inputs, so seed technology, if it's an organic operation, kind of organic solutions for production, they have to start at small scale. But there can be an opportunity once they're there in a viable business and supporting growers at the smaller scale, there's opportunity to leverage those at larger scale. And so this is an incredibly important part of fostering change at the large scale. Is the growth and support for the smaller operations?
I would agree. And for instance, the Blue Ox Malt House, for instance, that supplies the malt to many of the brewers in Maine, you know, they source about 5,000 acres worth of local grains from producers in Maine. And, you know, people can argue it's a chicken or egg. You know, you can't start a company unless you have that raw supply coming in, but farmers aren't going to just plant a whole field of something without knowing there's a proven market. And so slowly and surely we're working sort of both angles. And what it does is it gives assurance and confidence to the growers that they can scale up and that there can be other entrants into that market as well. And it lifts up the entire sector.
Commitments from both sides, and then your opportunity of harmonizing those, and as a fruition, we get incredible beer from, like, Lunch.
Incredible.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. good naming, too, right? I mean, mm-hmm. who needs Lunch when you got Lunch?
When you got Lunch.
That's right. Gray, let me read a little more about your background and what you do at CEI, and then we'll talk more about some of the specificity. Gray Harris is the Senior Vice President of Food Systems at CEI, the newly appointed Senior Vice President. Congratulations.
Thank you.
She is responsible for the strategy, the development, and the implementation of action-oriented business initiatives in agriculture, food systems, and aquaculture and fishery sectors in Maine, or as a collective, I should say. In her role, Gray assesses sector needs and identifies sources of specialized technical assistance and financing for startups and expanding business, as Renee was alluding to. This includes spearheading the development of funds for sector-specific lending and investing at CEI. Gray is a former director of Maine Farms and Future Program and a statewide business planning and grants program for Maine farmers. You participate on numerous action-oriented initiatives statewide, including Wolf's Neck Farm, which we had Dave and Fiona on, which was a wonderful conversation, and Maine Harvest Credit Union. So, and a marathon runner.
Half marathon.
Half marathon runner. Mm-hmm. Well, when you do it in Millinocket, Maine, I think that counts yeah. as a full marathon. And you completed that this weekend. So congrats on that, too.
Thank you.
Greg, could you tell us a little more about what you're up to at CEI and some of the impact you're having within food systems?
Sure. Two things. In addition to our day-to-day work of working with farm and food system businesses, getting them the business advising and other technical assistance resources they need so that they can grow and thrive and strengthen their businesses. In addition to that, introducing them to sources of capital at CEI and other places. And we can talk about that more in a second. You know, we have been at this for a while. The local food movement really took off in this latest iteration in around 2010. And we've been busy ever since. And as we started getting further down the road a few years ago, we realized, well, we can keep helping businesses and we'll keep helping businesses one by one as they come through the door, financing them one by one. But what if we were to really take a step back, get a bigger picture, and try to take a more systems approach or a bigger comprehensive strategic view of how do we amplify our impact and scale up the local food economy in addition to that one-on-one work, and really drill down on a value chain approach that looks at the farm, at all the businesses in between the farm and the consumer. So processors, aggregators, distributors, value-added producers, all the way to retail. And by identifying these somewhat discrete threads, we could assess risk, we could assess gaps in both the kinds of businesses, the kinds of capital available, the kinds of technical assistance needed, and we could do some quarterbacking to create access to those resources. Because as we know, a value chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And so the whole chain is at risk unless we really look at those weak links. And as folks who provide capital, as you know, anyone who provides capital, it's all about assessing risk and mitigating that risk. So it was a way to not only protect our portfolio and enable us to make better investments, but certainly all of our colleagues who we want to invite to the table to co-invest with us. It was really important to take that approach. So grains was one value chain that we worked on last year, and we'll continue to work on that as we go forward, of course, with those companies. And this year, we are taking a bit of a different approach to the value chain, kind of turning it on its head and recognizing that processing companies, that sort of middle of the chain type of operation, is this critical sort of bottleneck right now. And we really need to assess what are the opportunities for growing those businesses, starting up those businesses, that will have exponential impact on all the producers who need to use those businesses in order to get to market. So it's a get-to-market strategy, absolutely focused on local food production in Maine, with an eye towards markets that are regional, because Maine is only 1.3 million people, and Portland's our biggest city at 66,000. We have to look at markets outside of Maine, so Boston, New York, beyond. So that's one on the sort of strategic initiative side that has real, you know, actionable effect on the ground with businesses, and that's always key. We don't like to live in the world of theory. We really love action. And so that's one way we get to it, with a really strong strategic focus. And then the other thing we're working on is around access to capital. You know, we when someone comes to us, our number one goal is to make sure they have access to the very best capital for them and their business. And sometimes that's CEI capital, and sometimes it's not, or sometimes it's a blend of CEI's capital and other partners' capital. And that's what really excites me, is putting together those partnerships and really serving the business needs. And what we've been developing recently, because we saw a huge gap in the market, is for early stage equity investments, that kind of capital. So some people would call it seed stage, pre-series A, you know, sort of the friends and family amped up a little bit into businesses, into this food system work. Yeah.
Hmm. I would say that Maine hits above its fighting weight, right? So 1.2 million, yes. Mm-hmm. 66,000. I'm always amazed by Portland's only 66,000 people. It's, you know, it wins best food city of the year. It gets all these national acclaim. It's, I think, people's, you know, checked on top visit list. But it also seems to be a proving ground for a lot of this to come forward. Maybe because you've had to be a bit of a forced innovator in some of these spaces where you've had a lot of economic impoverished, is not the right term, but probably, you know, strained for a lot of the communities. I actually became first aware of CEI through the fisheries program and through seafood. And I think that might be an interesting scenario, because you had mentioned some of the offerings that CEI has. And I did look at the dossier of offerings: business loans, micro loans, new market tax credits, sub debt loans, SBA 504 loans, business plans, market plans, business advising, financial advising, public policy leadership. That's a long, impressive list that CEI puts out there. Maybe if you would tell us a little bit about some of those initiatives that are happening within the Maine fisheries, some examples of that, where CEI stepped in and provided some of this broad breadth of offering to your consumer base.
Sure. No, I'd love to. I think one of the most exciting projects we have going on right now is proving out new technology for growing scallops, scallop aquaculture. We've had a long time relationship with a prefecture in Japan to learn about what is called an ear hanging technology to grow scallops sustainably and have them really market ready. So we've gone over with a knowledge exchange. We've gone over to Japan. Our aquaculture and fisheries team has, and Japanese have come over here for this extraordinary exchange. And in the last year, we brought over all the machinery to pilot it in Maine waters, first in the nation piloting this in Maine waters. What was important to us, because we are a nonprofit and we are not businesses, we don't want to ever really take the place of business. We want to partner with businesses so they benefit and can really prove these things out. So we're partnering with a local mussel farmer who is, we're contracting with them to see what this machinery does in real time and does it work. And then we're going to share those findings widely, because as we look at our fisheries, which is predominantly lobster at this point, aquaculture is really rising as a way to diversify that income stream, especially in a changing environment and a changing climate. And you never know what the future will bring. Awfully good to not have all your eggs or lobsters in one basket. So we're really excited about that. So far, it's proving itself to be viable, at least in a production standpoint. And we're going to do the financial modeling to really show how can it be profitable. And then how do you get into it? You know, what's the capital requirements to get into it? But it's super exciting because it's an opportunity and it's sort of a hope for the future to keep the working waterfront in operation. You know, we have, a thriving working waterfront, but it is significantly smaller than it has been in the past, and it continues to shrink. And since it's such a cornerstone element of the Maine, you know, culture and heritage, it's really important to find ways to sustain that over time. So that's one probably our centerpiece program or initiative around fisheries and aquaculture. That said, we are working with all types of aquaculture producers to get them the business advice they need, financing that they need. Our team helps lead up a shared waters course, which is education to for fishermen and others who are interested in getting into aquaculture. And that's a 12-week course that's held. And, you know, interestingly, our team just last year was down in your neck of the woods. They did a study on the south coast of Massachusetts of the potential or the innovative potential of aquaculture to take root there in the New Bedford area, which was really informative for us and I think really helpful for the communities down there to just know what the questions are they need to be asking and issues they need to be aware of.
It's an interesting, that whole narrative you provided is a bit of a stitching together of some of the problems we've seen here in the Northeast. I mean, you've got, so starting in New Bedford, which is one of the, I think it's the largest, if you look at actual total dollars of the size of the fishery, because of the scallop fishery, which is all based off of open cod fishery, and they haven't invested in this type of technology. They're pressed a bit like what the Maine fin fishery ran into. And as you said, the Maine lobster industry, which I think is nearly $400 million a year, is a bit of a monoculture. But you're sitting on 3,500 miles of shoreline up in Maine, some of the most pristine, cleanest water that would be the best for this.
That's right.
Aquaculture or regenerative ocean farming, which when you're grazing up mussels or scallops or any bivalve, boy, you're doing good things for your ecology, too. There's a lot of benefits. Creating jobs, local dollars spent, mm-hmm. cleaning up the waters. It's a boom, boom, boom. That's multiple impacts, right? But how have you been at getting some of that existing workforce, the folks that were either lobstermen or fin fishermen, to look at aquaculture or farming different compared to what their previous world was?
Yeah, that's a really good question because, and you just said it, it's fishing and farming. It's not the same thing. So it's not an easy leap to make. That said, there's more attendance and participation in this year's Shared Waters program than I think in any year prior. aquaculture is hot right now. There are more folks applying for leases in our state than ever in the past. And it's very entrepreneurial, innovative time where people are just quite literally testing the waters for these ideas and just to see, you know, can they, you know, can they produce anything? Do they like producing anything? It's a really exciting time. It's sort of like any startup time. Sort of there's this aquaculture bubble, so we're paying attention, and not all of them are going to make it, but it's, you need to have all those entrants that are innovating and iterating and ideating to be able to figure out who in the end is really going to come forward with like the next great idea or the next great aquaculture practice. So we're seeing it's a sort of, it's confused right now, but super, super exciting. So we're certainly, our team, our fisheries aquaculture team, are very busy right now meeting folks and figuring out, you know, what do we need to do to bring them resources that they need in terms of capital, in terms of business advice to move this whole sector forward.
And also, just speaking on kind of the larger ag side, Cargill, which is one of the larger post-harvest players in the big ag space, they've made recent investments in the aquaculture space. And so I think the work that's being done at the smaller scale is really important, and it will have bigger implications for larger scale big ag. So to me, it's very exciting to start to see that diversification from a big ag player and to know that it could potentially be supporting something that's local and good for the economy and for the soon-to-be farmer fisherman.
That's a great point.
It'll be interesting to see how we're able to stitch those programs together, because Cargill has been very active actually in getting a federal policy out through subsidizing some of these aquaculture infrastructure. And a lot of it, I think, is focused on land production models and a lot of catfish producers, actually. But it does create an opportunity, which we haven't been successful on a lot of on the coastal communities, which is integrating fisheries into our overall food plan and making this so that, you know, we've got the Northeast, we've got the population densities, we've got all these major cities. This would be our foot in the door into our food and farm plan. And so maybe there is some impetus for us to meld all of these initiatives together. My favorite part of the seafood side of things are all the puns you get to use, by the way.
They're endless.
They are endless between finance and fisheries.
Well, hopefully there's something, maybe lessons can be learned or leveraging the work, the policy work that Cargill's trying to influence for the farmers on the coasts. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll have to start, big ag is there, so we have to start leveraging where we can to take advantage of the dollars that they spend to help move the needle on regional systems.
Seat of the table is an essential part, and I think what's exciting too from big ag's perspective is they're recognizing that consumers are interested in different things too.
That's right.
You know, elevated and differentiated food products are something that they have to be involved in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, someone was asking me the other day about, you know, what kind of investors do you work with? And I said, well, we work with all kinds of investors. You know, it could be philanthropic funders to impact investors to traditional investors. But where I keep coming to with this is we are all investors because we all eat. And so that consumer demand and the power of the consumer to really drive where the market is going to go is certainly going to be how we help the Cargills and the Monsantos see that there's a market opportunity. You know, we have to create that demand. Sure.
It seems that CEI is quite good as playing within the multi-stakeholder initiatives. From my understanding of dealing, especially in fisheries, maybe another good example of this, but you work with groups like GMRI, you work with Island Institute, UMaine, different political leaders. You seem to have a lot of diverse stakeholders that are all fighting for a similar battle, much spawned under your initiatives. How have you been able to manage that? I think that's a key question for anybody moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can speak more sort of cogently to the land-based side of things. You know, we realize that we can't do this alone. And our voice alone isn't as powerful as a coordinated effort with multiple voices. I like to think of myself as a serial collaborator. And so it's really important for me to identify what do we do well, what don't we do well, and then find those partners that fill in those gaps, and we get on the same page. Luckily, we do have consensus on some very basic principles around the agricultural economy, the local food economy. We want to see our communities grow and thrive. You know, we love the working landscapes. We really appreciate sort of the scrappiness and grittiness of our producers, and frankly, all folks who work in this local food system, trying to get businesses off the ground and successful. So it's in terms of managing, it's helpful to have something to focus on, you know, whether it's a value chain project or frankly a financing. If we can all focus on what the end game is, what we're trying to accomplish, it seems like it's been pretty easy to get folks around the table to figure out how to solve these problems. But it's ongoing, and it's not always, you know, certainly not easy, but if we can just show, you know, incrementally that we can move this forward, I think it just, you know, we will be able to change change where this the local food economy is going.
An iterative process, of
iterative
course.
We've
got to always focus on that. Mm-hmm. So we first met probably 4 or 5 years ago when we were on a panel together at the MIT Sloan's conference on circular economies. And I found it very interesting because then it was a bit of a spooling up of a term people were less familiar with. I know Renee's very active in this space as well, in the circular economies. But it, what I find now in understanding more of what CEI does, it seems that under one roof, you have a very creative and nimble financing device and vehicles that become a test ground for circular economies. Is that a focus of your organization?
I wouldn't say circular economy is the focus of the organization, but what we try to do is fill gaps. And we understand, especially being a rural organization, we naturally focus on natural resource sectors, which are based on ecologies, which are based on natural circular systems. And often we find that our financing and our business technical assistance has to match that. It's really, that was the genesis of the value chain approach, understanding that we can't just take a siloed approach to financing these businesses in discrete ways. We really had to see that big picture and where these businesses actually added value to each other all along the chain, and of course support the businesses that are also keeping a circular economy or circular strategy in mind. The main beer company, for instance, all of its waste from the beer process goes to local pig farms. You know, where do we see some of those circular regenerative practices happening? And I think with that in mind, one of our, we like to say we have strategic pillars, and certainly job creation is a big one for an economic justice and social justice organization. But another critical one besides jobs is environmental sustainability. You know, what's the legacy these businesses are leaving? What's our legacy? Who are we supporting? Is really important to us. And can't be 100% all the time, but if we know there's an intention there to move towards improving those practices, then we really want to get behind it and support it.
So I would love to hear a little bit more from your, thank you, I think that's really important, and how has that philosophy and how you guys have really started to implement it with kind of the value chain analysis, how has that impacted the investments that you guys are getting and who you're able to fundraise from?
Oh, interesting. The sources of capital.
Yeah,
because as you know, we're an intermediary, meaning we sit between sources of capital and uses of capital. And as I mentioned before, we work with funders of all kinds. So those could be investors, donors, philanthropies, banks, And they each come with their own sort of criteria or screen that they want to see. But certainly that environmental piece and the sustainability piece, and we're working on regenerative agriculture is some kind of new language, although soil health and has always been embedded in our sustainability approach. I would say it has been successful in helping to attract those funders, but not strictly environmental funders. They're definitely, they want to see that interconnection, that what we would call triple bottom line kind of investing that we do. It needs to be economically viable. It needs to be in good practical sense to make that investment. But they want to see the environmental impacts, and they certainly want to see the social impacts. They want to see the good quality jobs, especially for folks who maybe don't have as much opportunity to have those jobs. And that's been critical for them.
When you start looking at the triple bottom line, and as you said, this is not philanthropy. You know, you're working with different types of investors, commingling different types of monies. But you have a responsibility to those investors to give a return. But you're also, you're basically taking on that responsibility for whether it's local dollar spent or economic development or environmental impact. How are you assessing that? And then how do you deliver that as returns to those investors?
Right. And it really depends on the investor. And there's got to be an honest upfront conversation around expectations of returns. And how do we define success? How do we define what returns are? We have a subsidiary that's a venture capital subsidiary that's a fairly traditional model where the expectation is financial return, hockey stick growth, strong growth, good jobs. It has a social mission, create really good jobs, but it's more of a traditional growth pattern. We don't see that in all of the businesses that we have. So while I would say that there are those opportunities. We all know there's those opportunities for great financial return in a few of these businesses, and that's great, but it's not enough. Because if we're really going to change the way we source our food, the way we eat, and our local rural food economy, we need to be able to take a wider view on what returns are and the kind of impact we want to have. So how we measure that is how many acres of production are we putting in with this kind of investment? Are we enabling the next generation to get access to farmland? Are we creating not only really good jobs, but also more of those really good jobs? And are we supporting the kind of agricultural practices that are creating a legacy that enables the next generation to take over those farms? And really important, are we allowing family farms to be viable and able to make up the fabric of their communities? So it's a conversation, and it's a 3D lens, we like to say, around investing that looks at more than just financial returns. And it's really tricky. It's absolutely hard to know where you have to really look at yourself as an individual investor, understand what your comfort level is and what piece of your portfolio you're really willing to put at risk, knowing that success isn't necessarily defined in just one way. I mean, every investment we make as an intermediary, we have a fiduciary responsibility to safeguard and manage people's money, and we take that very seriously. So when I say that sometimes when a business fails, that isn't necessarily a failure. What I mean by that is that we're in a pioneering space. There are a lot of unproven models. Not all of these businesses, this is true in any sector, not all of these businesses are going to survive. But what we learn from those pioneers enables new market entrants, new folks to come and build even better and stronger businesses. And so by pioneering, we just move things down the road. And we're always asking, how do we move things along? How do we just get things further down the road, knowing that we're not going to knock it out of the park every single time?
Mm-hmm. And with the continued learning that you guys have on food system investment, mm-hmm. what is one thing you wish you could educate a larger group of investors on when they are looking at investing in the food and agricultural space?
One thing?
Top three.
Top three. No, I can. So really, the one thing, and this isn't going to come as a surprise, is to really have impact in the local food space. It's going to take a lot of time and a lot of money. It requires the long view, without question. These are not quick hits. It takes a lot of ancillary support, business assistance. We definitely work with investors who get involved in the space because they want to stay really close to the companies and really help them grow. And I would suggest that this industry right now really benefits from that. And so as an investor, you got to take the long view. And you got to be willing to really stick with it for a long time. The kind of capital that's needed is also that patient, long-term, flexible, equity-like capital that doesn't necessarily... There are investments where you... I don't want to suggest that there aren't companies out there poised for significant growth and exits in 5 years, 7 years. Absolutely not. We have some of those in our portfolio that we're thrilled about. What I'm saying is that there's a whole range, and all of those have to be on the landscape for that one that's really going to knock it out of the park to be successful. We've lost a lot of our backbone infrastructure. We've lost a lot of the businesses that enable those market scalers to really take off. And so someone needs to show up with that kind of patient, deep, equity-like capital. It's something we're particularly good at as long as we have that kind of capital on deck. And we've seen how that really has enabled other businesses to riff off of that and create just a more robust business landscape.
Those singles and doubles lead to more home runs eventually.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Gray, what can we expect to see from CEI in coming months or years?
Well, we are right now fundraising for the next iteration of our Catalyst Fund, which is that early stage equity fund. We're raising grant dollars for that. That's really important for us to raise that and put it out, get it to work in businesses that we really believe in, to give us the track record to really scale it from that point. That's one of the big priorities right now. Like I mentioned earlier, we really are focused on processing companies and understanding the current landscape in Maine and where are those critical control points where we can bring our focus, our attention, our dollars to either help existing businesses scale up, get new businesses launched, work with our portfolio companies to just continue to grow. That's a huge piece. And we're really looking at the quality jobs issue, especially in food system businesses, food businesses. It's a challenge. Often it's seasonal. Often the work conditions are just kind of tough, cold and wet and weird hours. What can we do to make those jobs, frankly, more sustainable over time, so people want to continue to work at it? We have such a job crunch right now. I mean, we have businesses that are desperate for employees, and there's just not the workforce out there. How do they make their businesses more appealing so people really want to go and work there?
Renee, final thoughts?
Well, I just want to say, I think the processing is a really important piece to that puzzle, is ensuring that you have, in fact, jobs available 12 months out of the year, and that processing can play, and cold chain, as long as you have cold chain storage to then allow processing facilities to be operating at off times, that's such an important piece.
Huge.
Well, I guess my final thought is I am excited about this space. The work that you're doing is really important.
Thank you.
And though your focus is on regional and your scale, the ripple effect is tremendous, and it's so important for large-scale regenerative ag practices. So thanks for the work that you're doing.
Thank you. It's good to hear that.
Yeah, great. I mean, it's as we've been talking about, it's a bit of an innovation economy. It's a proving ground. It's going to show a new model moving
forward. That's right.
Right. I'll close by saying, as Gray explained, that for modern investors and stakeholders, success isn't defined by by one factor anymore. And CEI is quarterbacking a broad dossier of offerings to address many of these bottlenecks we have within the industry, within the food systems as a collective, and are now establishing entirely new value chains. So I will reiterate Renee's point. Thank you so much for that great work, and thanks for taking the time to share these thoughts with our listeners. I learned a lot. I know our audience will learn a lot too, and we welcome you back anytime.
Thank you. I'll bring lunch.
Oh, you again. There it is. So
thank
thanks
you.
Again.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Gray. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks, Renee. Bye-bye.